This is my reading of The Bluest Eye, Spring, page 97. The first twigs are thin, green, and supple. They bend into a complete circle but will not break. Their delicate and showy hopefulness shooting from forsythia and lilac bushes meant only a change in whipping style. They beat us differently in the spring. Instead of the dull pain of a winter strap, there were these new green switches that lost their sting long after the whipping was over. There was a nervous meanness in these long twigs that made us long for the steady stroke of a strap or the firm but honest slap of a hairbrush. Even now, spring for me is shot through with the remembered ache of switchings, and forsythia holds no cheer. Sunk in the grass of an empty lot on a spring Saturday, I split the stems of milkweed and thought about ants and peach pits and death and where the world went when I closed my eyes. I must have lain long in the grass, for the shadow that was in front of me when I left the house had disappeared when I went back. I entered the house as the house was bursting with an uneasy quiet. Then I heard my mother singing something about trains in Arkansas. She came in the back door with some folded yellow curtains, which she piled on the kitchen table. I sat down on the floor to listen to the song's story and noticed how strangely she was behaving. She still had her hat on, and her shoes were dusty, as though she had been walking in deep dirt. She put on some water to boil and then swept the porch. Then she hauled out the curtain stretcher, but instead of putting the damp curtains on it, she swept the porch again, all the time singing about trains in Arkansas. When she finished, I went to look for Frida. I found her upstairs lying on her bed, crying the tired, whimpering cry that follows the first wailings, mostly gasps and shudderings. I lay on the bed and looked at the tiny bunches of wild roses sprinkled over her dress. Many washings had faded their color and dimmed their outlines. "What happened, Frida?" She lifted a swollen face from the crook of her arm. Shuddering still, she sat up, letting her thin legs dangle over the bedside. I knelt on the bed and picked up the hem of my dress to wipe her running nose. She never liked wiping noses on clothes, but this time she let me. It was the way Mama did with her apron. "Did you get a whipping?" She shook her head no. "Then why are you crying?"
"Because."
"Because what?"
"Mr. Henry."
"What'd he do?"
"Daddy beat him up."
"What for? The Maginot Line? Did he find out about the Maginot Line?"
"No."
"Well, what then? Come on, Frida. How come I can't know?"
"He picked at me."
"Picked at you? You mean like soap head church?"
"Sort of."
"He showed his privates at you?"
"No.
He touched me."
"Where?"
"Here."
"And here."
She pointed to the tiny breasts that, like two fallen acorns, scattered a few faded rose leaves on her dress. "Really? How'd it feel?"
"Oh, Claudia."
She sounded put out. I wasn't asking the right questions.
"It didn't feel like anything."
"But wasn't it supposed to? Feel good, I mean."
Frida sucked her teeth.
"What'd he do? Just walk up and pinch them?"
She sighed.
"First he said how pretty I was. Then he grabbed my arm and touched me." "Where was Mama and Daddy?"
"Over at the garden weeding."
"What'd you say when he did that?"
"Nothing. I just ran out the kitchen and went to the garden."
"Mama said we were never to cross the tracks by ourselves."
"Well, what would you do?
Sit there and let him pinch you?"
I looked at my chest.
"I don't have nothing to pinch. I'm never going to have nothing."
"Oh, Claudia, you're jealous of everything.
You want him to?"
"No, I just get tired of having everything last."
"You do not.
What about scarlet fever? You had that first.
Yes, but it didn't last. Anyway, what happened at the garden?
I told Mama, and she told Daddy, and we all came home, and he was gone. So we waited for him, and when Daddy saw him come up on the porch, he threw our old tricycle at his head and knocked him off the porch.
Did he die?
Nah. He got up and started singing, "Near my God to thee." Then Mama hit him with a broom and told him to keep the Lord's name out of his mouth, but he wouldn't stop, and Daddy was cussing, and everybody was screaming.
Oh, shoot, I always miss stuff.
And Mr. Buford came running out with his gun, and Mama told him to go somewhere and sit down, and Daddy said, no, give him the gun, and Mr. Buford did, and Mama screamed, and Mr. Henry shut up and started running, and Daddy shot at him, and Mr. Henry jumped out of his shoes and kept on running in his socks. Then Rosemary came out and said that Daddy was going to jail, and I hit her.
Real hard?
Real hard.
Is that when Mama whipped you?
She didn't whip me. I told you.
Then why are you crying?
Miss Dunyan came in after everybody was quiet, and Mama and Daddy was fussing about who let Mr. Henry in anyway. And she said that Mama should take me to the doctor because I might be ruined. And Mama started screaming all over again.
At you?
No,
at Miss Dunyan. But why were you crying?
I don't want to be ruined.
What's ruined?
You know, like the Maginot Line. She's ruined. Mama said so. The tears came back. An image of Frida, big and fat, came to mind. Her thin legs swollen. Her face surrounded by layers of rouged skin. I too began to feel tears.
But Frida, you could exercise and not eat.
She shrugged.
Besides, what about China and Poland? They're ruined too, aren't they? And they ain't fat.
That's because they drink whiskey. Mama says whiskey ate them up.
You could drink whiskey.
Where would I get whiskey? We thought about this. Nobody would sell it to us. We had no money anyway. There was never any in our house. Who would have some?
Cola,
I said.
Her father's always drunk. She can get us some.
You think so?
Sure. Charlie's always drunk. Let's go ask her. We don't have to tell her what for.
Now?
Sure now.
What do we tell Mama?
Nothing. Let's just go out the back, one at a time, so she won't notice.
Okay, you go first, Claudia. We opened the fence gate at the bottom of the backyard and ran down the alley. Pecola lived on the other side of Broadway. We had never been in her house, but we knew where it was. A two-story gray building that had been a store downstairs and had an apartment upstairs. Nobody answered our knock on the front door, so we walked around to the side door. As we approached, we heard radio music and looked to see where it came from. Above us was the second-story porch lined with slanting, rotting rails, and sitting on the porch was the Maginot Line herself. We stared up and automatically reached for the other's hand. A mountain of flesh, she lay rather than sit in a rocking chair. She had no shoes on, and each foot was poked between a railing. Tiny baby toes at the tip of puffy feet. Swollen ankles smoothed and tightened the skin. Massive legs like tree stumps parted wide at the knees, over which spread two rows of soft flabby inner thigh that kissed each other deep in the shade of her dress and closed. A dark brown root beer bottle, like a burned limb, grew out of her dimpled hand. She looked at us down through the porch railings and emitted a low, long belch. Her eyes were as clean as rain, and again I remembered the waterfall. Neither of us could speak. Both of us imagined we were seeing what was to become a Frida. The Maginot Line smiled at us.
Y'all looking for somebody?
I had to pull my tongue from the roof of my mouth to say,
Pecola? She live here?
Mm-hmm. But she ain't here now.
She gone to her mama's workplace to get the wash.
Yes, ma'am. She coming back?
Mm-hmm. She gotta hang up the clothes before the sun goes down.
Oh.
You can wait for her. Wanna come up here and wait? We exchanged glances. I looked back up at the broad cinnamon roads that met in the shadow of her dress. Frida said,
No, ma'am.
Well, the Maginot Line seemed interested in our problem. You can go to her mama's workplace, but it's way over by the lake.
Where by the lake?
That big white house with a wheelbarrow full of flowers. It was a house that we knew. Having admired the large white wheelbarrow tilted down on spoked wheels and planted with seasonal flowers.
Ain't that too far for you all to be walking?
Frida scratched her knee.
Why don't you wait for her? You can come up here. Want some pot?
Those rain-soaked eyes lit up, and her smile was full, not like the pinched and holding back smile of other grown-ups. I moved to go up the stairs, but Frida said,
No, ma'am, we ain't allowed.
I was amazed at her courage and frightened of her sassiness. The smile of the Maginot Line slipped.
Ain't allowed.
No, ma'am.
Ain't allowed to what?
Go in your house?
Is that right?
The waterfalls were still.
How come?
My mama said so. My mama said, you ruined.
The waterfalls began to run again. She put the root beer bottle to her lips and drank it empty. With the graceful movement of the wrist, a gesture so quick and small we never really saw it, only remembered it afterward, she tossed the bottle over the rail at us. It split at our feet and shards of brown glass dappled our legs before we could jump back. The Maginot Line put a fat hand on one of the holds of her stomach and laughed. At first, just a deep humming with her mouth closed, then a larger, warmer sound. Laughter at once beautiful and frightening. She let her head tilt sideways, closed her eyes, and shook her massive trunk, letting the laughter fall like a wash of red leaves all around us. Scraps and curls of the laughter followed us as we ran. Our breath gave out at the same time our legs did. After we rested against a tree, our heads on crossed forearms, I said,
Let's go home.
Frida was still angry, fighting, she believed, for her life.
No, we got to get it now.
We can't go all the way to the lake.
Yes, we can. Come on.
Mama gonna get us.
No, she ain't. Besides, she can't do nothing but whip us.
That was true. She wouldn't kill us, or laugh a terrible laugh at us, or throw a bottle at us. We walked down tree-lined streets of soft gray houses leaning like tired ladies. The streets changed. Houses looked more sturdy. Their paint was newer. Porch posts straighter, yards deeper. Then came brick houses set well back from the street, fronted by yards edged in shrubbery clipped into smooth cones and balls of velvet green. The lakefront houses were the loveliest. Garden furniture, ornaments, windows like shiny eyeglasses, and no sign of life. The backyards of these houses fell away in green slopes down to a strip of sand. And then the blue Lake Erie lapping all the way to Canada. The orange-patched sky of the steel mill section never reached this part of town. This sky was always blue. We reached Lakeshore Park, a city park laid out with rosebuds, fountains, bowling greens, picnic tables. It was empty now, but sweetly expectant of clean, white, well-behaved children and parents who would play there above the lake in summer before half running, half stumbling, down the slope to the welcoming water. Black people were not allowed in the park, and so it filled our dreams. Right before the entrance to the park was the large white house with the wheelbarrow full of flowers. Short crocus blades sheathed the purple and white hearts that so wished to be first they endured the chill and rain of early spring.
The walkway was flagged in calculated disorder, hiding the cunning symmetry. Only fear of discovery and the knowledge that we did not belong kept us from loitering. We circled the proud house and went to the back. There on the tiny railed stoop sat Pecola in a light red sweater and blue cotton dress. A little wagon was parked near her. She seemed glad to see us.
Hi.
Hi.
What you all doing here?
She was smiling, and since it was a rare thing to see on her, I was surprised at the pleasure it gave me.
We're looking for you.
Who told you I was here?
The Maginot Line.
Who is that?
That big fat lady. She lives over you.
Oh, you mean Miss Marie?
Her name is Miss Marie.
Well, everybody calls her Miss Maginot Line. Ain't you scared?
Scared of what?
The Maginot Line.
Pecola looked genuinely puzzled.
What for?
Your mama let you go in her house and eat out of her plates?
She don't know I go. Miss Marie is nice. They all nice.
Oh, yeah,
I said.
She tried to kill us.
Who? Miss Marie? She don't bother nobody.
Then how come your mama don't let you go in her house if she's so nice?
I don't know. She say she's bad, but they ain't bad. They give me stuff all the time.
What stuff?
Oh, lots of stuff. Pretty dresses and shoes. I got more shoes than I ever wear. And jewelry and candy and money. They take me to the movies. And once we went to the carnival. China gonna take me to Cleveland to see the square. And Poland gonna take me to Chicago to see the loop. We going everywhere together.
You lying. You don't have no pretty dresses.
I do too.
Oh, come on, Pecola. What are you telling us all this junk for?
Frida asked.
It ain't junk.
Pecola stood up ready to defend her words when the door opened. Miss Breedlove stuck her head out the door and said,
What's going on out here?
Pecola, who are these children?
That's Frida and Claudia, Mrs. Breedlove.
Whose girls are you?
She came all the way out on the stoop. She looked nicer than I had ever seen her, in her white uniform and her hair in a small pompadour.
Mrs. McTeer's girls, ma'am.
Oh, yes. Live over on 21st Street.
Yes, ma'am.
What are you doing way over here?
Just walking. We came to see Pecola.
Well, you better get on back. You can walk with Pecola. Come on in while I get the wash. We stepped into the kitchen, a large, spacious room. Mrs. Breedlove's skin glowed like taffeta in the reflection of white porcelain, white woodwork, polished cabinets, and brilliant copperware. Odors of meat, vegetables, and something freshly baked mixed with a scent of Fell's naphtha.
I'm gonna get the wash. Y'all stand stock still right there and don't mess up nothing.
She disappeared behind a white swinging door, and we could hear the uneven flap of her footsteps as she descended into the basement. Another door opened, and in walked a little girl, smaller and younger than all of us. She wore a pink sunbag dress and pink fluffy bedroom slippers with two bunny ears pointed up from the tips. Her hair was corn yellow and bound in a thick ribbon. When she saw us, fear danced across her face for a second. She looked anxiously around the kitchen.
Where's Polly? She asked.
The familiar violence rose in me. Her calling Miss Breedlove Polly, when even Pecola called her mother Mrs. Breedlove, seemed reason enough to scratch her. She's downstairs, I said.
Polly,
she called.
Look, Frida whispered. Look at that.
On the counter near the stove in a silvery pan was a deep dish berry cobbler. The purple juice bursting here and there through crust. We moved closer.
It's still hot, Frida said.
Pecola stretched her hand to touch the pan, lightly, to see if it was hot.
Polly, come here,
the little girl called again. It may have been nervousness, awkwardness, but the pan tilted under Pecola's fingers and fell to the floor, splattering blackish blueberries everywhere. Most of the juice splashed on Pecola's legs, and the burn must have been painful, for she cried out and began hopping about just as Mrs. Breedlove entered with a tightly packed laundry bag. In one gallop, she was on Pecola, and with the back of her hand knocked her to the floor. Pecola slid in the pie juice, one leg folding under her. Mrs. Breedlove yanked her up by the arm, slapped her again, and a voice thin with anger abused Pecola directly and Frida and me by implication. "Crazy fool! My floor! Mess! Look what you work! Get on out now! Crazy! My floor! My floor! My floor!" Her words were hotter and darker than the smoking berries, and we backed away in dread. The little girl in pink started to cry. Mrs. Breedlove turned to her.
"Hush, baby, hush. Come here. Oh, Lord, look at your dress. Don't cry no more. Polly will change it."
She went to the sink and turned tap water on a fresh towel. Over her shoulder, she spit out words to us like rotten pieces of apple. "Pick up that wash and get on out of here so I can get this mess cleaned up." Pecola picked up the laundry bag, heavy with wet clothes, and we stepped hurriedly out the door. As Pecola put the laundry bag in the wagon, we could hear Mrs. Breedlove hushing and soothing the tears of the little pink and yellow girl.
"Who were they, Polly?"
"Don't worry none, baby."
"You gonna make another pie?"
"Course I will."
"Who were they, Polly?"
"Hush, don't worry none," she whispered. And the honey in her words completed the sundown spilling on the lake. "See, Mother is very nice. See, Mother, Mother is very nice. Mother, will you play with Jane? Mother laughs, laugh, Mother, laugh, laugh." Page 110. The easiest thing to do would be to build a case out of her foot. That is what she herself did. But to find out the truth about how dreams die, one should never take the word of the dreamer. The end of her lovely beginning was probably the cavity in one of her front teeth. She preferred, however, to think always of her foot. Although she was the 9th of 11 children and lived on a ridge of red Alabama clay 7 miles from the nearest road, the complete indifference with which a rusty nail was met when it punched clear through her foot during her second year of life saved Pauline Williams from total anonymity. The wound left her with a crooked, archless foot that flopped when she walked. Not a limp that would have eventually twisted her spine, but a way of lifting the bad foot as though she were extracting it from little whirlpools that threatened to pull it under. Slight as it was, this deformity explained for her many things that would have been otherwise incomprehensible. Why she alone, of all the children, had no nickname. Why there were no funny jokes and anecdotes about funny things she had done. Why no one ever remarked on her food preferences. No saving of the wing or neck for her. No cooking of the peas in a separate pot without rice because she did not like rice. Why nobody teased her. Why she never felt at home anywhere or that she belonged anyplace. Her general feeling of separateness and unworthiness she blamed on her foot. Restricted, as a child, to this cocoon of her family spinning, she cultivated quiet and private pleasures. She liked, most of all, to arrange things. To line things up in rows. Jars on shelves at canning. Peach pits on the step. Sticks, stones, leaves. And the members of her family let these arrangements be. When by some accident, somebody scattered her rose, they always stopped to retrieve them for her. She was never angry for it gave her a chance to rearrange them again. Whatever portable plurality she found, she organized into neat lines according to their size, shape, or gradations of color. Just as she would never align a pine needle with the leaf of a cottonwood tree, she would never put the jars of tomatoes next to the green beans. During all of her 4 years of going to school, she was enchanted by numbers and depressed by words. She missed, without knowing what she missed, paints and crayons. Near the beginning of World War I, the Williamses discovered, from returning neighbors and kin, the possibility of living better in another place. In shifts, lots, batches, mixed in with other families, they migrated, in 6 months and four journeys, to Kentucky, where there were mines and millwork. When all of us left from down home and was waiting down by the depot for the truck, it was nighttime. June bugs was shooting everywhere. They lighted up a tree leaf, and I seen a streak of green every now and again. That was the last time I seen real June bugs. These things up here ain't June bugs. They something else. Folks here call them flyflies. Down home, they was different. But I recollect that streak of green. I recollect it well. In Kentucky, they lived in a real town. 10 to 15 houses on a single street with water piped right into the kitchen. Ada and Fowler Williams found a 5-room frame house for their family. The yard was bounded by a once white fence against which Pauline's mother planted flowers and within which they kept a few chickens. Some of her brothers joined the army. One sister died, and two got married, increasing the living space and giving the entire Kentucky venture a feel of luxury. The relocation was especially comfortable to Pauline, who was old enough to leave school. Mrs. Williams got a job cleaning and cooking for a white minister on the other side of town, and Pauline, now the oldest girl at home, took over the care of the house. She kept the fence in repair, pulling the pointed stakes erect and securing them with bits of wire, collected eggs, swept, cooked, washed, and minded the two younger children, a pair of twins called Chicken and Pie, who were still in school. She was not only good at housekeeping, she enjoyed it. After her parents left for work and the other children were at school or in mines, the house was quiet. She could arrange and clean without interruption until 2 o'clock when Chicken and Pie came home. When the war ended and the twins were 10 years old, they too left school to work. Pauline was 15, still keeping house, but with less enthusiasm. Fantasies about men and love and touching were drawing her mind and hands away from her work. Changes in weather began to affect her, as did certain sights and sounds. These feelings translated themselves into her in extreme melancholy. She thought of the death of newborn things, lonely roads and strangers who appear out of nowhere simply to hold one's hand, woods in which the sun was always setting. In church especially did these dreams grow. The songs caressed her, and while she tried to hold her mind on the wages of sin, her body trembled for redemption, salvation, a mysterious rebirth that would simply happen, with no effort on her part. In none of her fantasies was she ever aggressive. She was usually idling by the riverbank or gathering berries in a field when a someone appeared with gentle and penetrating eyes who, with no exchange of words, understood, and before whose glance her foot straightened and her eyes dropped. The someone had no face, no form, no voice, no odor. He was a simple presence, an all-embracing tenderness with strength and a promise of rest. It did not matter that she had no idea of what to do or say to the presence. After the wordless knowing and the soundless touching, her dreams disintegrated. But the presence would know what to do. She had only to lay her head on his chest and he would lead her away to the sea, to the city, to the woods. Forever. There was a woman named Ivy who seemed to hold in her mouth all of the sounds of Pauline's soul. Standing a little apart from the choir, Ivy sang the dark sweetness that Pauline could not name. She sang the death-defying death that Pauline yearned for. She sang of the stranger who knew. Precious Lord, take my hand, lead me on, let me stand. I am tired, I am weak, I am worn. Through the storms, through the night, lead me on to the light. Take my hand, precious Lord, lead me on. When my way grows drear, precious Lord, linger near. When my life is almost gone, hear my cry, hear my call.
Hold my hand, lest I fall. Take my hand, precious Lord.